awkward now until I'm around for, or say before that, we'll stop earlier. And then we have some books, and we'll hang out inside books.
We
Will hang out inside books talking. And that'll be at 4 o'clock, or maybe even before 4 o'clock. And that's what we're gonna do, all right? Okay, and a good idea. Just wave your arms just like that, and my voice falls
Falls.
because I'm speaking in a dream, so I have to be reminded there are other people in the room trying to hear me, not just mumbling to myself. No. I'm speaking to you. You are speaking to me. We're speaking together about continuous practice. Dogen's great essay, Continuous Practice. And it took me several decades to realize, because Dogen appears when you first start reading him, he appears so ineffably mysterious that you have no idea what he's talking about. And it took me several decades, maybe three, to realize that actually what he's usually doing is beginning his essay with a very broad, poetic, and gorgeous statement about what he's talking about in this essay. And then he begins to tell Zen stories, one after the other, that are in some way related to this overarching theme that he's set out in the beginning. So this morning I was talking to you about the theme of continuous practice and how Dogen defines and understands continuous practice. And now I'm going to tell you a story or two from the cache of many stories that he tells in this fascicle, which has two parts, and he tells lots of stories. So these are all people who exemplify continuous practice. These are all exemplars, people we're imitating or we're becoming through our continuous practice. And guess who the first person he cites is? Buddha, right? Buddha. So I'm going to read you what he says about Buddha. And again, this is Kastanhashi's translation of Yoji. This is Dogen. These are Dogen's words in Kastanhashi's English. Compassionate father, great teacher Shakyamuni Buddha was engaged in continuous practice in the deep mountains from the time he was 19 years old. At age 30, after practicing continuously, he attained the way simultaneously with all sentient beings on the great earth. Until he was in his 80s, his practice was sustained in mountains, forests, and monasteries. He did not return to the palace, nor did he claim any property. He wore the same robes and held the same bowls throughout his lifetime. From the time he began teaching, he was not alone, even for a day or an hour. He did not reject offerings from humans and devas. He was patient with the criticism of people outside the way, wearing the pure robe and begging for food. The Buddha's lifetime of teaching was nothing but continuous practice. So that's Dogen's one paragraph summary of the Buddha's lifetime of continuous practice. So, every religion has a founder, and the founder's life is a kind of mythical life that is, I think, carries the whole of the teaching of that particular tradition. It's meant to be a life that expresses the teaching of that tradition. So it's like that with the historical Buddha, who is a kind of example that we look to understand what the tradition is telling us and how we are to receive it and practice it. And I'm sure everybody here knows the usual story of the Buddha as conveyed in the Pali literature, repeated in many other places, a little bit different in emphasis from what Dogen says. Everybody knows about how that the Buddha was a prince, talented and privileged young man, whose family sheltered him, preventing him from seeing what the world was like, so that he would be sure to keep to the straight and narrow path of wealth and power that was his birthright. But the Buddha couldn't quite manage that. He couldn't keep to the straight and narrow path. He wanted to find out for himself what life was really like. So he snuck out of the palace, where he encountered on successive trips a sick person, a very old person, a human corpse, and a religious mendicant. And these four experiences shook him to the core and made him realize that no amount of wealth or health or power or intelligence was going to prevent sickness, old age, and death, that these things were realities that were inescapable and they were going to happen to him, and they were going to happen to everyone. Well, I am far from the Buddha, but I had a similar shocking experience when I was a boy, and I remember very well, someone told me the terrible news that everybody has to die. I thought that was absolutely unacceptable. So unfair, right? I mean, yes, okay, maybe some people were really rotten people, and they had to die. I can accept that. Maybe some people were not so great. They had to die too. What about a great person, a really good person who had done absolutely nothing wrong? I guess as a child, I thought such a thing was possible. That person would also have to die. No, I absolutely could not accept that. I thought it was shocking, it was horrifying, and it was absolutely unfair. And I now, looking back, realize that was the beginning of my spiritual path, for sure. I never got over that to this day. Never got over it. Now, in the case of the Buddha, there was an element of compassion involved. Because I think when he saw the sick person, he felt for that sick person. When he saw the old person, he felt for that old person. When he saw the corpse, he felt for that person who formerly was alive and now was gone. And he wanted to do something, not only for himself, but for all these people. He wanted to help people in the future overcome these seemingly intractable human dilemmas. And that's where the fourth experience, seeing the religious mendicant, came into it, because he saw that as a way of overcoming these things, a way of religious questing, with everything left behind but the quest itself, a path that would be the way to solve this seemingly impossible dilemma. Did you ever think of that? Did you ever think the Buddha thought that he's going to solve birth and death? Who but a privileged young guy, right, would ever have such an outrageous idea? But he did, apparently. The chutzpah, right? I'm going to go forth and I'm going to solve once and for all the problem of life and death. That was what he did. He thought he could do that. And Even though, by all accounts, the Buddha's physical body came to the end of its living time after many decades, tradition tells us that he did go beyond birth and death, that he did show a path through and beyond birth and death, a path that others could follow, a path that Dogen calls continuous practice, a path beyond birth and death. Notice that Dogen does not mention any of what I just told you in his accounting of the story of the Buddha. Of course, Dogen is very well aware of that, but he's not concerned about all of that. His concern here is to talk about Buddha's great road that unfolds after he goes forth from his palace life. Probably most of you who have heard and told yourselves the story of the Buddha would recognize that usually they say the Buddha went forth at the age of 29. And here Dogen has it at 19, apparently in the Japanese tradition. I don't know why they say 19. But he begins his path in the deep mountains. And for Dogen, these two things go together. Continuous practice in the deep mountains, they're almost synonymous. And in China and Japan, Zen temples were always located in the deep mountains. And even when they weren't, they pretended they were, naming the temples mountains. And the mountains are places of profound quiet, wild places, natural places. Already in Taoism, before Buddhism ever landed on Chinese shores, there was lore about the deep mountains. And it's a true thing. The deep mountains, and here, the desert mountains. You just walk a few steps into the mountains and you feel like you're in spiritual practice already. The mountains have an aura about them, a world apart, completely distinct from the human world. I actually traveled to California in order to practice Buddhism. When I first started practicing Buddhism, I didn't even know there was anything to practice in Buddhism. And someone told me you could practice it in California, so I went to California to do that. The only place that I could imagine going. Other people smarter than me said, oh, but what about Japan and India? To me, Japan might as well have been the moon. Small town boy, I never thought anybody, any like regular person, could go to Japan, China, or India. But California was daunting enough for me. Oh, California seems pretty exotic in and of itself. And I went. And California also has beautiful mountains, high Sierra Mountains. And so that's what I did when I first got to California. I would go into the mountains and I would spend weeks at a time by myself in the high mountains, shining granite peaks, the amazing alpine lakes like a mirror, the high passes, the wind blowing through them. It was awesome to be all by myself a long time in those places. So I really get it, the confluence of the deep mountains and continuous practice. This idea of nature as the mystical source of spirit is more or less absent in original Buddhism, the Indian Buddhism. But in Chinese, in all Far East Asian Buddhisms, this is the idea. Mountains and deep nature and continuous practice are the same thing. And we in America have a long history of nature writing and nature mysticism. White settlers established early on, but that, of course, existed here long before they arrived. The native religions of this land were that. The monastery where I practiced, Tassajara, some of you I know have been there, is also in the deep mountains, very far from human habitation. I so appreciated my years practicing there, essential to my formation as a Zen priest. To get to Tassajara, you drive down a 14-mile dirt road, up and over the mountain pass. Tassajara is a narrow canyon. When I first arrived there, it was just beginning to be developed as a Zen Buddhist monastery. And the silence was so profound. And one of my most precious early experiences was hearing the sound of the Densho bell, a great big Japanese bell that had a sound that reverberated through that canyon, and watching the monastics in their black robes going back and forth to the Zendo. And it seemed to me then, and I still feel this way now, that the Zen round of repetitive activity, focused and quiet, was the human equivalent of what the stones and the trees and the brush and the animals were just naturally doing in that canyon and had always done. But if continuous practice is the deep mountains, it's also, of course, more than that. The deep mountains are not only in the deep mountains, they're everywhere. Because continuous practice is the wilderness of the heart, the wilderness of our native, open, pure presence. And that's what Dogen means when he says that Shakyamuni Buddha did continuous practice in the deep mountains of his own heart and mind. His whole life through, he looked steadily and hard at his own life, inside him and outside him. A thought, a tree, a cloud, the face of a person, the voice of a person, the song of a bird, all are continuous practice. Maybe you noticed how Dogen says that when Buddha was about 30, he awakened, but not, as you might have read in other stories, all by himself under a tree. Dogen writes, he attained the way simultaneous with all beings on the great earth. And this is not just Dogen's conception. All of Zen masters say that the Buddha attained awakening with all beings. And that at the time he said, how wonderful, I and all beings together awaken in this moment. And isn't that continuous practice? Not confined to an individual, but continuous between us and among us. Buddha does not strive and achieve a personal spiritual victory. His great effort is continuous practice that results in the letting go of all effort and all achievement. He comes to identify with all beings everywhere, and he becomes all beings everywhere as they become him, at ease and awakened. And this sense of solidarity and identity and complete peace is the freedom from sickness, old age, and death that the Buddha has sought from the beginning. And the only way that he finds it, the only possible way he could find it, is simultaneously with everyone. Buddha's awakening did not only change his life, it has changed our lives too, these many thousands of years later. It has changed all of life. So, in the usual story, that's sort of like the end of the story, you know, problem, big effort, solution, end of story. But no, in continuous practice, it doesn't go like that. That's just barely the beginning. Buddha does not bask in his awakening, going to the beach for the rest of his life. As Dogen tells us, at the age of 30, on into his 80s, the Buddha engaged continuous practice, not only in the deep mountains, but now also in the towns, in the monasteries, among rulers, among all classes of people, often in cities, keeping on with continuous practice. He never returned to the palace as he might have done, reclaiming his throne and his possessions. He might have well have thought, why don't I become an enlightened ruler? But he didn't do that. Instead, he wore the same robes every day, and he held the same bowls throughout his lifetime. When you ordain as a Zen Buddhist priest, you receive Buddha's robe and Buddha's bowls that you are to keep for the rest of your life and wear and use for the rest of your life. Robe and bowl are the traditional marks of the wandering Buddhist religious teacher. They are symbolically the only thing that he or she truly possesses. Dogen goes on to tell us that the Buddha gave himself completely to others, trying his best to help. Maybe the Buddha would have preferred solitude and peacefulness, but he was never alone throughout the rest of his life, traveling with other monastics here and there to teach and live among others, always sharing his life and his point of view as best he could, patient with people who could not see what he had seen and so criticized him or ignored him, rejecting no one at all who came to seek advice, no matter how impossible. He even had conversations with the Devas, non-human beings that were floating around. Day by day, month by month, year by year, decade by decade, he traveled the great circular road of continuous practice, going nowhere. Thinking about the Buddha's continuous practice makes me think about my own teachers who followed the Buddha's example. You would think that, as with so many things in this life, a person might come to the end of the line with practice. You know, you retire, stop teaching, enjoy the quiet. I don't know, maybe take up painting or something. And some Zen teachers, in fact, do this. But my own teachers did not. My main teacher, Sōjin Weissman Roshi, began his practice in his 30s. He ordained as a priest within 5 years of that, 5 years or so. And from then on, he did continuous practice every day until he left this life at the age of 91. Continuous practice the whole time. Some of his disciples in his temple might have thought, it'd be nice if he would retire. They might have appreciated him retiring. In fact, there was a time when he said, oh, you know, maybe I should retire, but I can't. What would I do? I'm only able to do continuous practice. And he never did retire until his life ended. He practiced right up until the end. Our Zen tradition in America and in the West is actually pretty new. It's a generation or two old, 50 years, 75 years. And we have no idea what's going to happen in the future, what it will look like, whether it survives or not. But it's a very unusual, actually, this tradition here, because it is essentially a monastic tradition of total commitment that is mostly practiced by laypeople in the West. In Asia, monastics practiced Zen and the laity supported them. In the West, it's lay people practicing this intense monastic practice. Now, as you know, there are priests in Zen, and we wear Buddha's robe and the bowl. We have the bowl, as Dogen says. But even these people like me, who presumably are committed to continuous practice, we too are lay people. We are not celibate monastics living as hermits or in monastic communities, although some of us, many of us, spend some time in those communities. We don't necessarily live our whole lives in those communities, and there are many Soto Zen priests who have spent no time or very little time in such communities. Sometimes they have spouses, children. I myself have two children and five grandchildren. They have a house that they live in. A lot of them, like Al, have significant careers outside their Zen practice. So that's unusual. Most Zen practitioners in the West, in fact, you could say pretty much all of them, are lay people who must take their lay lives of lay sort of ordinary activity seriously. Their lives as workers, whatever they are, scientists, professors, electricians, doctors. There's a number of doctors I know who are physicians who are Zen priests. Certainly their lives as parents, spouses, friends, neighbors, those roles for us in the West have to be taken as avenues of continuous practice, which makes our practice very interesting, challenging, and unique. So let's see how this goes. We're just starting. However, one thing about all these people, in the variety of their circumstances, and I would say this is true without probably a single exception, all these people practice intensive zazen. The standard for most practitioners is daily sitting with long periods of a week at a time or more, possibly, as I said, months or years of intense monastic practice, during which they abide in the deep mountains, in quotes, of continuous practice. And during that time, all of them, no matter what their other roles, during that 1 week or that one period of time, they are practicing exactly as the Buddha did, giving up everything, devoting themselves only to zazen, living lives for those days, weeks or months or years of continuous practice and continuous observance, meditation, and formal practice. If you read the stories of the Buddha in the Pali Canon, you realize that all of the Buddha's teachings were given in the context of his daily life. They were all contextual. Usually the teachings were abstracted from the context, but if you read the original text, they're all contextual. And they show a person not only who gave a student detailed spiritual instructions, but also a person who was very, very kind, very, very compassionate. That's why Dogen calls him our compassionate father. A person who had an unbelievable amount of patience with the foolishness and self-sabotage of those around him, and would gently urge them to practice without ever forcing them or guilt-tripping them. He would say, well, what if you did this? How about a little this or that? What do you think? That be good? He would talk just like that. And he would have to accept, as one does, that they will not listen. They will not go in the direction that you know would save them a lot of trouble. They are going to have to go sometimes in a way, maximum trouble, no matter what you say or do. The Buddha was a person who saw all that. He was steady and clear in his daily living. He was never in a hurry. He was never pressed or pressured. He did not overdo or underdo. So this is how we try to live in imitation of the Buddha's life, shaping our personalities around him, each one of us in a very unique way, because we're all different. From the standpoint of continuous practice, human life is absolutely impossible and at the same time, absolutely perfect. We have everything we need. We live in history. And historical time floats this way and that. There is always a disaster to address, a war to win or lose, a crisis to be averted or endured. Dogen's view of time that we talked about this morning seems to take us beyond history to a place of serenity and depth that is always available in any moment. But at the same time, we do appear in a particular time and place. And it won't do to paint over that particular time and place with a vague brush spiritual truth. I don't need to repeat what 10,000 podcasters and columnists and book writers have told you already. We all know this. We're living in very interesting and challenging times with the technological progress that most of us don't even understand what it means. With so many people having so much wealth, the earth has never seen so many trillionaires and billionaires. And even the average person who's not at all wealthy has gadgets and cell phones and flies on airplanes. So it's a great time. A tough time. Stress and upset, maybe such as we've never felt before. Fear and dread that are commonplace every day. I don't think this is the first time that humanity has been quite unsure of itself and its prospects for the future. There were many times in the past when the end of time was just around the corner. So I read the same publications and media that you do. And I see the same world of really difficult politics, and I see the same multiple crises that you see. People are very anxious. Everywhere, all over the world, which makes them erratic and very apt to believe in very crazy ideas and to support crazy policies and extreme leaders, or themselves become violent and deranged. There's a lot of that going on, and whatever of it there is, we all know about it. news spreads all over the world in seconds. So it's a little disturbing. And it will change at some point. Of course it will, but nobody knows when or how. I don't know how many people appreciate that pretty much all of the Buddhist teachings, including certainly Dogen in his time, came out of times of great crisis and stress, at least as bad, probably worse than what we are experiencing now. And that Dogen and other great Buddhist sages of the past practiced Zen not as an expression of their great peace and serenity, but as a direct response to a world gone out of control. Zen practice is not out of this world. It is radically in this world. It provides, as far as I can see, the best way to live in difficult times without going nuts or shutting yourself up into some fake world. Living in the world as it really is, feeling everything that there is to be felt, with the eyes wide open and the heart wide open. I don't know of any other way to do that but to do Zen practice or some other practice that is more or less the equivalent. So I think there are three qualities that Zen practice will help us to cultivate in order to live in these times of difficulty. Here are the three qualities I think we need: stability, confidence, and hope. And our practice will help us, I think, naturally, to feel these three qualities. These are what our ancestors have handed down to us. These are in the teachings. And with the practice of Zazen, we can survive with some grace and even some good humor. And other people actually need us to be that way because they're depending on us. I always think that if I'm in a room like this with 100 people in it, I think that's about 10,000 people. Because every one of you be encountering many other people. And every moment of your encountering them with confidence, stability, hope, and good humor is a moment that they will feel blessed. This physical world, the earth and everything on it, including our bodies, is the most stable and the most sane thing there is. Think of the earth with its trees and oceans and sky. It is very solid. It is very reliable. We have been relying on it from the beginning, and we will rely on it as long as there are human beings. To be sure, things are changing all the time. Things are born and they die and they decay all the time. But everything that dies is reborn. Life passes away and comes back. We feel terrible, as we should, that we are ruining the earth with all of our carbon emissions that we're so deeply addicted to. We can't figure out even how to slow down the rate of increase, let alone the increase. But the earth will sustain itself despite that, just as it has sustained itself throughout many millions of years of its temporary existence, as many huge and drastic changes have happened. So we can absolutely depend on the earth and the trees and the sky and the plants and the animals who you have noticed are sane. The animals are not going crazy. They're stable. So are our own physical bodies. We might be crazy, but our body is very sane and stable. That's why it is so important in our practice to pay attention to our body and to our breathing and to our perception, to our seeing and hearing and tasting and touching and smelling, because all of that grounds us in the material world. And when we're grounded in the material world, in our actual bodies, in our actual breathing, in our actual perception, our emotions will be grounded. They will be stable, even when there are very good reasons to be upset. We will be stable. Somebody once told me that when first responders go to the scene of an emergency, paramedic, arriving at the scene in an ambulance, they are taught to say to anyone, no matter what the condition, "It's all right. You're going to be okay. Just take a breath. Another breath." They say this to them even before they have any idea what's wrong with them. Before they know what their condition is or whether or not there's any chance at all of them surviving, they say that to them. "It's okay. Take a breath." They're alive now, even if their life is only moments long. And they're grounded in their bodies. So in that moment, regardless of what their condition is, they are okay. So it's true to say it's going to be okay, whatever the outcome. If the outcome is death, death will be okay. We can accept death with grace when we are here, grounded and stable in the body, in the heart, and in the mind. The Buddha spent his entire life wandering around, entertaining people's spiritual questions. And people often asked him really impossible questions. What happens after we die? Who created the universe? What is nirvana? Stuff like that. And famously, the Buddha did not have answers to those questions, and he remained silent. You think, he might have said, "Well, those are questions I can't answer." Or, "Those are questions that don't help. I don't want to entertain those questions." But he didn't say that, because I think he understood that no matter what he said, people will never stop asking those questions. They ask them even now. "Do Buddhists really believe in rebirth?" How many times did someone say that to me? So he knew there's no use talking people out of these questions. That's why he remained silent. But one thing he remained quite sure. And if you study the accounts of the night of Buddha's awakening, you read about this. He experienced this on the night of awakening, so he knew it to be true. And it's this: that good thoughts, words, and deeds will lead to good outcomes, and bad thoughts, words, and deeds will lead to bad outcomes. And this is a universal law. Now, the Buddha was not a magician or a prophet. He did not predict the future. No one can predict the future. So he never said, if you do this, exactly this will happen in this way. Because the vast network of causal relations is so complex that no one could foresee it. But he did know for sure that one way or another, over time, it is always good. It is always efficacious to be good. And it's always a bad deal to be bad. These are not the first times in which we would ask the question, but wait a minute, how come all these bad guys are so successful? That's true. How come the bad guys keep winning and the good guys keep losing? That may or may not be true. But even if it is true, the Buddha remains quite clear that good is good and bad is bad. And I say that because knowing this gives us confidence, really unshakable confidence, that we are capable, every one of us, as we were saying this morning in response to the question, every one of us is capable, no matter what our condition or station in life, of doing good. And if we do good, it's a good thing, and the consequences of that action will be good. And that we can avoid doing bad stuff. And if we avoid doing bad stuff, that will be a good thing. Not only for ourselves and our friends, but rippling out to the whole world. All outcomes are unsettlingly uncertain. We never know what's going to happen. But it is clear that if we are strong and straightforward in our doing good and our avoiding doing bad stuff, this is going to be good. In the long run, it's good. So we have a lot of power. I think a lot of people feel frustrated. We have no power. We all have a lot of power, every one of us. Each one in our own sphere, in our own way, to do good. And to know that this doing good will matter. It will be effective. To be alive is to have the capacity to do good. As long as we can do good, we are strong. It's a very good thing, and we can affect the world all around us. Doing good doesn't just mean doing good externally. A good thought, a kind word, a smile is doing good. Do you think it's better to be an optimist or a pessimist? I don't know. I think the world needs a lot of optimists and pessimists. I think if everybody were an optimist, it would not go well.
Yeah.
And if everybody were a pessimist, that would even be worse. So if you are born predisposed to be a pessimist, be a pessimist. If you are born predisposed to be an optimist, be an optimist. Either way, there can be hope. Because if you really pay attention closely to what life actually is, you realize that life itself is inherently at all points hopeful. Here's what I mean. The spiritual world, especially in the Buddhist universe, people say, the only moment is the present moment. Be in the present moment. They say, the only moment is the present moment. The past is gone. The future has not yet arrived. Well, that's kind of true, but look at that more closely. The present moment? It's gone already. Right? As soon as I say present, it's gone before I even get the first two concepts out. Before you even are living in the present moment is already gone. There is no present. No. What present moment are they talking about? Gone. There is no present moment. The present moment, think about it a little bit and analyze it, and you realize the present moment is a logical impossibility, physical and logical impossibility. And you also know from your own experience that when any present moment arises, the entire past is already there in that moment. Because you are still you in that moment, right? Where did you come from? All the moments that preceded this moment. So there is no present moment. The only thing there is the whole past that arises now. Your whole history, the whole history of your family going back how many generations, the whole history of your world is right here in this moment arising. So the present moment is actually not a present moment, it's the whole of the past arising. But also, the present moment is the future. Because the present moment is the momentum that carries over into a future moment. It's a funny thing, like you look at a child, right? And you can see that what's beautiful about a child is the potential child to grow. The child has not yet grown. But you look at the child and you're seeing the child that's going to grow and has not yet grown, even though some children tragically don't make it to grow. So potential, meaning that which has not occurred, is actually a thing that occurs in this moment. You see it. You can actually see it. In every moment, that's what you're seeing. Every moment you're seeing the potential for the future moment. So there is no present moment. There's only the future moment here in the present moment about. When that's no longer the case, when there's a present moment, there is no momentum spilling over into the future moment. That's what we call the moment of death. Otherwise, every other moment, except for that one moment, has the future in it. And this is brilliant. As long as we're alive, what being alive means is that there is a next moment. That's what being alive is. What's going to happen in that next moment? Nobody knows. Nobody knows what happens in the next moment. It could be a fantastic moment. It could be the next moment, literally, right now in your life, could be the best moment of your entire life. Because it has never existed before. And it is unknowable. Anything could happen. If you're a pessimist, you're going to think, something terrible is going to happen. If you're an optimist, you'll think, something great will happen. But the pessimist doesn't know, and neither does the optimist know what's going to happen. It could be anything. Could be something terrible. Of course it could. I mean, have terrible things happened already? Yes. Plenty of them. So we know terrible things certainly can happen in the future. But also, great things can happen. And even if something really terrible happens, well, there's another moment. And you don't know what's going to happen in that moment. Another terrible thing could happen, but also a great thing could happen, right? You don't know. I was just in Detroit. I'd never been in Detroit before. Detroit is a city that has been through a terrible collapse. I mean, unbelievable collapse. 2 million people lived in Detroit, and now there are 600,000 people They had a night in Detroit annually. They don't do it anymore, but they had a night in Detroit called the Devil Night. It was the night before Thanksgiving when people would set buildings on fire all over the city. There would be like a thousand houses and buildings burning in Detroit because there were so many empty buildings all over the city. Terrible. And now something new is growing in Detroit. Detroit is quite inspiring to me. My friends that I visit there, because every collapse is the beginning of something, right? To be alive is to be living in the midst of a hopeful situation. No matter what happens next, even if it's a catastrophe, life is exactly hope. And when you practice, this is very obvious. I mean, I'm giving you a whole bunch of words and ideas. It's interesting to think about this, but you don't need to think about it. You just know this when you practice. You wake up in the morning and you think, wow, I'm alive. This is great. I don't know what's going to happen. This could be the last day I'm alive. Never mind, I'm happy. It's great to be alive. No one needs to talk you into this. You don't need to reason your way into this. This is how you feel. You practice, continuous practice. And when you are lucky enough to have encountered Zazen, I mean, I remember very well. I never heard of anything Zazen meditation. I remember when I first heard about it. To me, it's like, whoa, just sit there and breathe and do nothing. What a brilliant idea. I would have never thought of that in a million years. And you know, in the West, really, nobody really ever thought of that. Right? But when you have the ability and the possibility of practicing Zazen, you are sitting down right in the middle of that moment in which the ineffable, endless past and the unknowable future moment of being alive. With the body, with the breath, with the awareness, which is our life. And when that becomes for you, not just a curious exercise that you did on Saturday in Tucson when this guy came from out of town, blah, blah, blah. But this is what you do. This is your culture. This is your life. This is what you do. Use us. Now, this stability, this hopefulness, this confidence in your own activity is good, will be just second nature to you. You won't have to think about it or worry about it. It will just be the most obvious and natural thing in the world for you. That's why it's so vitally important now more than ever has been. Now we realize how important it is for us to practice. And maybe some of you here practice in other ways, or it doesn't matter how you practice. Prayer is all kinds of ways of practicing. A lot of people practice by being artists, by absorption in their art, many ways. But one way or the other, to engage in this activity, continuous practice, is more essential now than ever for these reasons. There's an old saying. In Zen, the world is upside down, meaning the world works and people do things exactly in the opposite of the way they should. Instead of being loving and peaceful, they fight with each other. Instead of being present, you know, they're obsessed with the past or dreaming about the future. It's an upside down world, and it always has been. In order to live in an upside down world, you really need to do continuous practice because then you can live in that world with stability, with happiness, some real delight, and you can be a blessing to others if they need it. So I'll end my talk with a poem, which may have nothing to do with any of this, but somewhat. Wake up. Okay, thank you. Thanks for reminding me. How did I do? Did you lose me? Most of the time I was okay. Good, good. Okay, here's my poem. Thinking slow or fast. Thinking slow or fast, poetry is a process of elimination. Adjudication works well at night when the judges are asleep. And those who open the doors in the morning, open them to wide acclaim. Here's to one more word or several to fill a line, and then mean something to you. A thread to hold on to. At noon, while you are swimming, where the water runs in and out, a dilemma is always presented to us food eaters on earth, and then a question to be entertained. Slowly, a rope is lowered down into the hole, as if it could lift us out of here. But we're not sure we want to go up. It takes such effort in the opposite direction from the one we go in normally with our friends. Time never runs out. Time runs on. Around, up, down, in, but never out. Thank you for listening. I hope you had as much fun listening as I have yakking. So now I have a question for you. And I think we have the time for this. I went on longer than I thought I would. Maybe it's 3:30, right? How'd that happen? I thought it was about 3:28, yeah. So I think that given that it's 3:30, let's do this in about a 10-minute period, less than 10 minutes. So I think in place where you are, turn to someone next to you, two people, and it'll work out. Either everybody has a partner or one person won't, right? Isn't that how mathematics and we'll take care of it. So everybody find partners. It's better to talk to somebody. If you came with a friend, don't talk to that friend. Find a person to talk to, and once you have a partner to talk to, I will give you a kind of something to talk about. Okay? So very quickly, we've done that. Everybody has a partner. But right, everybody without exception has a partner. If there's one person without a partner, raise your hand. No, except you. Okay, so what I'm asking you to talk about, although of course this is flexible, if you want to talk about something else that's really on your mind, don't feel constrained by this. Well, what I'm thinking about is this. There's four of you there, right? Yeah, two and two. Okay, so is this what I was talking about? Stability, confidence, hope. Remember? Yes. What do you make of it? You, in terms of your own process, your own practice. If you heard it and you said, I never thought of that before, or whatever, it was intriguing, or I don't agree with it, or I already know it, or here's what I can do with it, or here's what I'm confused about it, whatever it is, talk for about 2 or 3 minutes, no more than that. Somebody, the other person, can bother listening and they can time 2 or 3 minutes. Or maybe I'll time you. Okay, so everybody can talk, let's say 3 minutes, exactly 3 minutes. So the other person, don't ask any questions. Just listen. Just listen. No questions. Okay. 3 minutes, one person, I'll ring a bell. 3 minutes, the other person, I'll ring a bell. And then another couple of minutes to have me on air. Okay. Got that? Okay. So I'm going to look at my watch and start. If whoever goes first, it doesn't matter. Somebody goes first. Start talking. 3 minutes. Go ahead.
What when we have to keep the room?
Yeah. When is this book coming out? I don't know. I don't know. It'll be a while because Shambhala just recently said they were interested in doing it, so I don't know. At least here. Oh, thank you.
I need it.
You need it. She's just, what you heard. She was wondering when, I was saying that this is material from a book that's coming out from Shambhala called Continuous Practice, and she wanted to know when it's coming out, and the answer is, I don't know when it's coming out. It's usually a year or more, at least a year, I'm sure. At least a year.
I don't need the microphone. I'm sure everybody can hear me, but I'll use it anyway.
Right. No, I'm trying. Quieter. I was a first responder for a number of years, and not as a paramedic, but as a firefighter, as an EMT, and I would be very careful before saying to someone, you'll be all right. I might say, it's okay, but you'll be all right is something that is I hesitated to do, maybe because I didn't want to make a promise that I couldn't keep.
Did I say you'll be all right? Did I say that?
Yeah, I didn't mean to say that. It'll be all right. It's okay. It's okay. And is it true that, I mean, somebody told me, is that true that that first responders are taught to say that it's okay?
I was never taught to say that.
You said that.
I said, I would sometimes say, it's okay.
It's okay. Yeah.
Even though they're bleeding, and, you know, it's okay.
Well, that just goes to show you, don't believe. People teachers say all kinds of impressive things. Most of them are not true. Stories and anecdotes. Do not believe them. Yes. Gwen, I'm going to give you the mic. Give me it.
It's a term for saying things that you don't know the outcomes. We call it false reassurances. And it's frowned on. It's considered in many circles unethical. So what you can say
in medical.
Yes. What you can say is you have the very best folks looking after you.
Yep.
I am going to take the very, very best care of you I can. We are near the hospital. They are good at treating this, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
But no guarantees.
Yeah. Yes, no guarantees. I think that makes sense. Yeah. I just want to add, you take someone's blood pressure and you go, oh, what else?
How do you personally deal with the dynamic of telling people to do something good? If you are in an environment where everyone has their set ideologies, how do you personally work with that?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. You mean if somebody says punching somebody is good, and another person says no, being kind is good?
What I mean is that you're saying do the right thing or do something good. But then if you have a room where they're coming from different religious perspectives or political perspectives or different ideologies, and their ideas of good might differ, How do you deal with that?
Well, I don't really deal with it. I mean, I assume, of course, everybody's going to have a different idea. Of course they are, of what's good. And so I trust people to do good based on the best idea that they have about what being good is. And yes, I can very well imagine someone doing what they consider to be good that I don't think is good. But then how do I know it's good? I just trust people to, I mean, I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who don't necessarily think in terms of doing good. They just think in terms of what's best for me or what's most expedient. So I would challenge people to say, I would challenge people to rather try to do what's good instead of just what's good for you or just what's expedient. And then I would have to, what else could I do? Trust that whatever they think is good, that's what they should do. The world's complicated. Does anybody really know what's the right thing to do in a complicated situation?
Okay, so Norm, you've written a lot of stuff. So do you have a favorite amongst all your literary children you've produced? Do you have a favorite work that you love, and why would that be? And or if people have never read anything you've ever written, what book would you recommend of yours that they should purchase? He didn't ask me to do this. I
Clearly, one of the two we have here for
sale. Yeah, it depends on which two you have here for sale. And when you greet me, I'm up. There you go. There's the answer. One of the books that I really appreciate, mine, is Opening to You, Zen-inspired translations of the Psalms. And that book has really endured for a long time. So, and I like that one because it's not me, it's not my words, it's the actual Psalms that I tried to translate from the Hebrew as faithfully as I knew how.
And did you have a Jewish upbringing and a Jewish background?
Well, I have a Jewish upbringing and a Jewish background. I did, yes. So I like that book, but the other book that people have read a lot is Training in Compassion. Training in Compassion, yeah. But I don't know. I just have a bad case of logomania, graphomania.
How can you choose which child?
Yeah. Which child is your favorite child? What else?
So I've been grappling with this problem, like I said.
Hold the mic closer.
Closer?
Yeah.
Since your talk this morning, so I get the idea of the self in the abstract. When you talk about there is no self, and I'm trying to figure out how I interact with these other conduits of life that I'm attracted towards some and not others. So where does this selflessness come in? How does that work?
Did I really say there's no self? I say that?
Not today.
I didn't really say that. Anyway, yes, of course, we all experience being selves, right? So how could we deny that? But when you look at it closely, it is an ever-changing experience. It's a very odd experience, really, being a person, I think it's really odd. Because on the one hand, you say, I'm me, I've always been me. But on the other hand, if you think about yourself when you were 5 years old, there's nothing about the five-year-old self that you now experience. There's literally not a molecule in your physical body that was the same molecule that was in your body when you were 5 years old. And your whole sense of who you are is the feel of it, right? The subjective feel of it is completely different. And maybe you've noticed this. I've noticed that I think that I'm in charge of my thoughts, like I think I'm thinking, right? But I don't think the way, I'm 78 now, I don't think the way now that I thought when I was 40. I have a different, whole different way of thinking, looking at the world. I certainly don't feel about the world the way I felt about it when I was 12. So how come I'm so convinced that this same person, myself, well, I think it's a convention. It's a convention, a necessary convention. If I went around saying that, well, I have a different name, I change my name every few years, how about if I change my name every 5 minutes? Because, right, I'm different every 5 minutes. Different now, because I've been in this room with all of you, and I've heard you, and seen you, I'm a different person now, literally, right, just as you are. So it's not that there's no self, it's just that the self is an ever-changing subjective experience. So that's not complicated, no. It's just...
What I heard was that you said that we make ourselves like this little box, this little shoe that's kind of
tight foot,
and that's really good. And then there is a much larger self.
Yes. I mean, one of the things about the self is that when we define the self and try to not recognize that it's an ever-changing expanse of experience, then just like you're saying, it can be very painful, right? What if you are a very unsatisfactory self that is not at all measuring up to one's own your own expectations, right? That's not good. Think about what a miserable life that would be. And I think all of us have some kind of version of that, hopefully mild version of it. But an extreme version of that would be very miserable because you'd be unhappy all the time. Every word and deed that came out of your body and mind and thought would be painful and unacceptable. And you would not like anybody around you because you would be thinking that they were all judging you with the same harshness that you were judging yourself, and then you would have a lot of mean people around you that you didn't like. So that would be the extreme version why a very tightly defined self subject to critique and judgment would be a very painful thing to live with. So this is the question of recognizing the expansiveness, the ungraspability, the ongoing changingness of being a person. And being generous about that within yourself and with other people, right? So it's really that. I mean, there's the philosophical ins and outs of whether a self actually exists is kind of fun to think about if you like to think about stuff like that, but it's not the point. Yes, here you are. He's next. He doesn't need a mic, but he's having the mic. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask if hope is a natural side effect of continuous practice, or is it a choice?
I think it's a natural side effect. I think that you become hopeful when you do continuous practice. I do. The other person, right here.
Talking about the self, I think we all know that famous line, I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. I was told that the Zen equivalent is, I think, therefore I think I am.
I think, therefore I think I am. Well, you know, it's a funny thing that you mentioned that because I have a friend who was a brilliant writer and he became a professor of English at Columbia University in New York. And then he gave that up and went to Hollywood and became a writer for screen and TV. And he wrote a lot of great TV shows and movies. And then he retired from that. And about a couple of 6 months ago or so, he sent me his novel. He's written a novel about Descartes. Imagine writing a novel about Descartes. He did this. It was a really good novel. I mean, because he's a sort of an amateur philosopher, so he's really interested in Descartes. And he went into all of, the history of Descartes and his thought and everything. So I was really impressed with his novel, and I read it, and that, of course, made me go down the rabbit hole of reading Descartes, which I had never read before, and I did this. And the reason I'm telling you all this is because one of the chapters in Continuous Practice is about Descartes. And Continuous Practice, I don't know what's going to happen with it, but the task I set out for myself was, I thought to myself, if continuous practice really is all-inclusive, right, then there's nothing that's not continuous practice, including Descartes, or anything else I feel like putting in there. So the book has all of these wacky things. It has, like, I have a whole chapter on Pinturn Abbey by Wordsworth, and all kinds of things that I put in there, like a big grab bag. And I thought, who's going to want to publish this? Nobody will do it. But Shambhala apparently is doing it. But I haven't yet had a conversation with them about how this chapter has to go and that chapter. We'll see how that goes. But it's got all this stuff in it. And I was really quite amazed by Descartes. You know how he got to this thing about, I think, therefore I am? He said to himself, I think, see if I get this right. He said, he was an incredibly smart guy. He was like the leading scientist of his age. He was both the leading scientist, an engineer, and genius guy. And my friend's novel is about Descartes, who in real life had lost a daughter. He had one daughter who died at the age of 7. And he, in the novel, Descartes, who was a brilliant engineer, actually creates a model complete with internal organs and a heart and everything of his daughter who died. And when he finishes the novel, the daughter gets up from the workbench and starts walking around. Comes to life. That's what the novel is about. So he was a genius guy. And he said, like, I'm going to do a thought experiment, and I'm going to see, like, what is certainly irrevocably true. And then he did things like, do I have a body? Well, seems like I have a body, but, maybe not. And he goes on and on about how, I've seen things that looked real to me but weren't. Like I saw mirages in this, and all this. Anyway, in a very thorough way that is really remarkable, he decides that there's absolutely nothing, including the entire world, that he can really be certain of. It's just not certain. It is subject to doubt. Everything is doubtful. The only thing that is not doubtful, the only thing, is that I am doubting. And that's how he gets to, I think, therefore I am, because he said the only thing that is not doubtful is that I doubt. And it's actually kind of a brilliant, brilliant thing. And he was quite an amazing thinker. He didn't go to school. He thought going to school was a real waste of time. He thought that all the science of his day, he thought, was completely wrong, because it was all based on Aristotelian concepts. So he kind of recreated modern science. He actually created modern science from the Aristotelian scientific systems. He's quite a genius, Descartes. He probably did continuous practice.
I'm sure.
Yeah, because he lived and died with a great deal of serenity. He decided that fooling around with regular people was a waste of time, because it was all full of controversy and opinion. So he never engaged in any. He wrote a set of rules for himself. I can't remember what they were, but I give them in the book. When he set forth in life, he set up rules for himself so that he could live a life that wasn't trivial. And he was he came from a family of nobility, so he had means. And he would always live outside the city, not in it. And he would always, live a very simple life. He had a whole set of principles that he adhered to his entire life so that he can live a life of significance. He was quite an amazing guy.
Time's up.
Yeah, that's the end of the news. Thank you, everybody. So,
thank you for doing for you now and thank you for doing for every year for
university that can sponsor it.
And we'll hang around for a while.
Take it easy. Keep going with your continuous practice. Everybody needs it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Go back to your continuous training.